you want me to grab one?
No, I'm okay. I can wait till caucus. I won't die between now and then.
All right.
If I do, it won't be for lack of a reason.
You are rolling.
This is collective bargaining on June 7th, 2018 between the University of Central Florida Board of Trustees and the University of Central Florida Chapter of the United Faculty of Florida. I have before me a draft of the minutes of the May 22nd.
You say that with enough drama?
May 22nd minutes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's like announcing Superman.
It's like announcing
Superman.
So just so you know, John, number 7 we didn't discuss. So I didn't write it. Everything else, Lily, I believe truly that we actually discussed. But that one was sort of put out, and we didn't spend a lot of time discussing it. So I'm trying to make more note of that.
You could have snuck that one by me today, Charlie.
That is never my intent. I'm always forthright.
Like a Mountie.
Can I borrow your pen? I didn't bring my big.
One fish you need.
I think so. Alrighty. that happens, unfortunately, more than... So you said it was no dairy, no...
It's like, it's no dairy, no egg, completely vegan.
So ground up plants?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
That's
I call it bird food.
So are you vegan?
I just try to keep it.
Yeah.
As much as possible.
As much as possible,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't...
John, were we 6 to 9 last time?
Right. That needs to be fixed. That we were 10 to noon, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, we were 2:30 to 4:30.
Yeah, we were in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Fixed time.
Good
That's
catch.
That's the part of the template that you don't
yep.
look at. Okay, fixed time 2:30 to 4:30. Got it.
Yep. Okay. So with the change regarding the time of the meeting on May 22nd, 2018, it looks like the minutes are acceptable.
Yes. Good. So while we've got the minutes and the future bargaining sessions down there in front of us,
yes,
we have a suggestion about the next two sessions, at least.
Okay.
So we get quite a bit of work done when we're in the room, but then the problem is we're not in the room long enough to get all the work done. So we like to suggest, in order to get this done before the current contract expires, that we just do all-day sessions on the 17th and the 2nd. And if we need another one that we were talking about the week of the 21st, we do that as well to try to wrap this all up.
Well, we'll... Why don't we...
You're kidding.
We're optimistic.
No, you're kidding.
Okay. I mean, I'm not saying
I have
okay.
to look at it.
All day schedule, but
I have to look at it and see if it's even possible to... But we'll talk about
Well,
what days are we talking about?
The 17th of July and the 2nd of August.
And you still owe me days for the fall.
Well, that's why. We were thinking we can get it done. And not have to worry about those dates.
Well, I'd still like to schedule them, though, because there's a lot of work going into scheduling a meeting. You would not believe all the different little pieces that you have to do to get the meeting scheduled. So
Charlie, you're asking for dates in case.
That we don't get it
done. Right, that's the attitude. On the off chance we can't get it all done.
Okay. Okay, John. When we take our first caucus... of the afternoon, we'll talk about it and give you an answer.
Okay, sure. I think we can do it. I'm optimistic.
Uh-huh. I'm optimistic too.
But But Mike's smile isn't quite as broad as mine.
As an old English major, I always ascribe to the saying by Alexander Pope, hope springs eternal.
I was telling Sherry a lot of contracts. I've closed out a lot of contracts in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
FIU, FSU, UWF.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they've all gone. They've all gone to ratification.
Oh, good.
And through ratification.
Oh,
it's funny to me, you know, when these contracts go to ratification, like at FSU, there's like two no votes. You know, there's like hundreds of yes votes and two no votes. I'm like, who are the two no votes? Like, is the ballot upside down? You know?
Well, that happens here too.
That
routinely.
Happens here because they go like.
Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yep,
nobody's unanimous. Who voted against Ken Griffey Jr.?
I guess so.
One person.
A Pittsburgh Pirates fan.
I heard today on the radio that Terrell Owens has turned down the trip
that.
To the Hall of Fame.
Well, he's 44. He's up there yet.
Really?
Well, he says he's going to celebrate by himself in a different location. He just doesn't want to participate in the induction ceremony.
Wow. Really? He's going to come out of retirement at 44. Wow.
Maybe he needs the money.
Whoa. Well, more power to him.
Yeah.
He's going to play in the CFL.
You're anxious to get him over there, huh? Okay,
so what's first on the agenda for today?
Well, we wanted to check on the status of Article 2 and Article 7, that package that we gave you last time.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to take it. I think we're going to take those articles up individually.
Okay.
And I think you gave us 22 last time, so we thought we would have a discussion about that. That's why Jana is here, so we thought we'd take that up first, because since she is not... This is not part of her official job duties like the rest of us here. She would like to go get out of here before 4:30 or 5 o'clock.
What? She doesn't want to hang out here with us?
No, she doesn't even want to hang out with us.
You're all equally non-hangable.
Jeez.
I know.
Think
how we feel.
Well, Jan, take it away.
Well, we have an article.
Yeah, we need to put the article on the table.
Well, now, I thought it was going to be first the talk, then the build-up, and then the, then the presentation. And then the... Okay.
Mike was a little late getting here today, so he didn't have as long enough time to bring him up to speed.
So are the changes, they're tracked off the status quo? Is that?
I think so. I think some of your ideas were incorporated, because I think there's some will shalls in here. That's because John has been here. And the the repetition of the numbers afterwards has also been addressed in every case. So that there's offensive numbers that follow the words.
And there is a change back from language in, let me see here, 22.1, okay, just lines easier to do this, 104 and 5, this is 104. We had said eligible employees on sabbatical shall continue to accrue leave on a full-time basis. You wanted to take out some of the excess language there, but you wanted to remove eligible and just put employees. And the reason that we changed it back to eligible is because we have the same language repeated in professional development leave. So between the two, it covers all the in-unit employees, but they have different people who are eligible for professional development leave cannot take sabbaticals, and people who are eligible for sabbaticals cannot take professional development leave. So it makes no sense to say just employees, because you are implying that anybody in the entire bargaining unit could take a sabbatical, which is not true, or that anybody in the bargaining unit could take a PDL. So it's the same language. It just is distinguishing between you have to be eligible because you have to, So.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm not sure it's necessary. It says employees.
Well, I know what we're. I think what we sometimes try to do is when we say employees, that is, means anybody in the bargaining unit. And so we're trying to be specific that there is a distinction between these two programs.
I mean, functionally, it won't make any difference.
No.
Right? We're just striking an extra word.
Well.
You're saying all the different developments, right?
Applying for it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that one's highlighted in yellow, and.
Oh.
On the previous page, on lines 86 to 88, there's one.
Right.
Passage in yellow, too.
Okay.
And I'm trying to.
Oh.
I think that's what we talked about in the couple, wasn't it? That was language that kind of came up together, went together and inserted.
No, I don't remember inserting that, saying that. Yeah, but we didn't talk about being ineligible to apply for 10 years. I know that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even have to look at my notes to know that. That did not come out of our mouths.
Okay.
The beginning of that.
So then the other yellow on 202 and 203, that's just the complementary language about on a professional development.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's in the right section, right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, that'll give us something to
look at.
Yeah,
and Jan, do you want to address that issue? Because needing to be tenured to apply?
So I'll give you my perspective on it. Well, first I'll say that I think there's a whole lot of confusion on the campus about the original language, which I don't have the original on this one, but I think that some individuals interpreted the original language as having to be tenure the time application, some didn't, so any clarifications are good. But my perspective for this is that a sabbatical is a benefit of tenure, one. Two, in our process, if a tenure-earning faculty were to apply for sabbatical and then not get tenure, by the time they actually know that, it's when the Board of Trustees do the final tenure approval, which is sometime in late May-ish. At that point, it's too late for anybody else who was not able to take the sabbatical to then quickly change plans.
Oh, so that's not true. I've done that myself.
I
did that myself personally.
But if you're accepting fellowships, you have to decide long before.
right? But there are lots of faculty who don't have fellowships. That's a minor component of the sabbatical program. So I personally did that when my department chair, the current department chair, moved from the faculty up. That relinquished the sabbatical, which I then used because I was the next one on the list.
If you were the next one on the list, but
yeah.
So the next person on the list already has turned down an opportunity. They can't, so we just keep going down the list till we get to what?
Yeah, till you exhaust your sabbatical. That's the procedure.
Well,
we've had that for a long time.
She's saying if the next person on the list turned down their opportunity because they couldn't get a sabbatical, then
it doesn't seem
fair
to skip them because they could have been the next person on the list.
But it's exceptional. If that argument holds true, then it's exceptionally unfair to penalize everybody because of one possible scenario that may or may not be operative.
So
what you're saying is that because this event, which may or may not be rare, could occur, we're therefore going to change the whole program. No, that makes no sense.
Never,
I'm sorry.
We're not changing the program. We're keeping it the way it is.
We've always said that you had to be tenured to get a sabbatical. Now, the question came up with, do you have to be tenured when you...
The language is very clear. No, the application.
And no one's...
It said eligible for the sabbatical.
Yeah, you'd be tenured.
Yeah, everyone is agreeing that you are tenured when you receive a sabbatical.
Right.
The question here is on application.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's a stipulation that you're trying to make outside of bargaining. That language is exceptionally clear.
Well, there's also a change of dates, right? Didn't we talk about the change in how long before you went up for tenure had changed with the old language?
So, well, before I got here, so sometime in the 90s, tenure used to happen in your year 6. Now it happens in your year 7. So it used to be you had 5 years, and then in your year 6 you went up. Now you go up in your year 6, so you're tenured in year 7. So I don't know how far back this goes, but...
This is blue book language.
So it made sense. It made sense in the earlier, because you would have been tenured or you would have been gone at that point. Now we've extended the 10-year probationary period. Again, this has been near on 20 years now, I think, at least.
That's probably 1999, 2000.
Somewhere around there. And we haven't changed this at all. The other part of this would be a faculty who extends their 10-year probationary period for whatever reason. They adjust their tenure clock, and now they might be applying for sabbatical in their year 6, but their tenure clock is extended 2 years. If they don't get tenure, we reward them with sabbatical, and then they end up not getting tenure. It's a weird confluence of giving back your time to the university. It makes sense to me as a benefit of being tenured that the sabbatical is a benefit of being tenured.
That all folks who are tenured should be allowed to apply so that as soon as they're tenured, they get their sabbatical. It literally means in the 7th year. And so that would be for folks who come in without prior credit, the year in which they're given tenure. It's very clear. You can parse it however you want, but it's very clear.
Another way to look at the term sabbatical is it's not just in the 7th year, but every 7 years,
right.
Which is what this,
right.
That there's 7 years between sabbaticals.
No, it's in the 7th.
In the,
it's like every Sunday,
six,
Chuck. Like
six
every
years
Sunday
without the,
is the Sabbath.
Yes.
Right.
I get it. I understand.
Seven.
Never mind.
So we're still apart on that.
Yes, we're very far apart on that one. So let's move on.
Because
we've got a couple things we want to check. So on Article 8, the non-discrimination article, we seem to be pretty close on it.
Before we move on, John, I guess from my point of clarification, are we finished with 22?
We are finished with 22.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are bloggers on that.
We're not going to come back to it. We're going to finish where we're at with right now.
Yeah.
Okay, we're agreeing to disagree.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
We're not modifying our proposal to incorporate that.
I just wanted you to...
Some released.
I wouldn't say the word released, but I would say that you have
the
opportunity
option to
stay or leave.
Freedom.
Yeah, this is a public forum, so you're welcome to stay. We'd love to have you, but I know you have a very busy schedule, and it sounds like we've completed discussion for the day at 22.
Yep.
Thank you. Okay. It looks like you have something, John. You have your hand.
Well, we do, but we wanted to check on another one that we felt we were close on.
Okay.
So it was the non-discrimination article.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is our turn.
Yeah, and we have one for you.
Oh, you have one for us. Okay. That's all we wanted to know. Because we were close. So then, or you felt we were close. Yeah. That's good.
The file is getting small real fast.
Well, that's okay. We'll fill it up here in a second.
So this is our proposal number 4. For Article 6, non-discrimination.
Okay. All right, so.
Okay, so the first change, I hesitate to say this, but I don't think it should be controversial. We struck that involves a student. And we're talking about stalking because we just don't think it should be acceptable to stalk anybody, not just students. So. Let's see.
I'm sorry, which lines?
97.
Oh, 97. Okay.
Which is basically a way of getting around this issue with OIE and us that when we can, we will bifurcate these issues and we'll handle the ones that are not discriminatory in nature and send them over to OIE. If we can't, and we're not trying to prevent anybody from grieving this. We just think it needs to be handled by the appropriate party, and we don't want to slow up handling other allegations. Because sometimes it takes OIE a little longer than it takes us, since we're contractually bound in the time it takes us.
So let me ask a question on line 102.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the far right-hand side of that line, to separate the alleged violations of this article instead of or?
It should be up.
Should be up? Okay. So when I'm just trying to figure out, I'm just trying to make sure I understand what this says. So correct me if I go off in the wrong area. So the first line is saying that when academic affairs determines that there's been a violation that includes some sort of discrimination, and also has some other elements, then. The investigations get bifurcated, so OIE takes the discrimination part, and the other one go down the track for the grievance procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so then the grievance procedures are just exactly what we've written, right? So it's the normal timelines and all that. Okay,
all
okay. So that part, okay, that part I think I've got. So then if it's not feasible to separate them for whatever reason, then there's a sequential process. So first OIE does their investigation, and then the grievance goes after it. Is that what that next sentence means?
Yeah, exactly what John described.
Yeah, you're correct.
It's sequential.
Okay, yes. Sequential. Okay. So then would we, how do we address the timelines and the grievance procedures?
For the purposes of the way I understand it and how I know it works at a couple of universities, for the purposes of a grievance that is at its essence and so intertwined with an allegation of a violation of Article 6 that it cannot be bifurcated, then it would be stayed while the investigation would go on. And then the investigation would issue a report with findings that one would hope would resolve the issue. But if it does not resolve the issue to the satisfaction of the bargaining unit member, they could then grieve.
So there probably needs to be a clause to that effect.
Yeah. You mean the
to suggest, to say
yeah.
that, yeah.
Right.
If that's what...
Right, if that's the case.
Is that correct? That's how I understand it's done. I know some other universities who follow this process.
Yeah, I think we just would need some additional language to capture that, just so everybody's clear on what the procedure is.
Yeah.
Because hopefully, whatever comes out of the office doing the investigation will resolve it.
Yeah, but if it doesn't, we're not trying to cut you off from
your remedy. It's just
we're not trying to time you out of your remedy by sending it over to OIE. So if we need language in here that would clarify that, we can certainly do that.
Yeah, I think just so that everybody's clear on what the procedure is, because I think we understand the intent of it, is that if it is so intertwined with discrimination, then we've got...
I don't think those are
we have
very
issues.
Common, but they could occur, and so we just want to try to prepare for eventuality.
Well, if you think about it, if you're grieving your annual evaluation, and people tend to tack on discrimination on top of it, it doesn't really matter whether there's discrimination or not. The question is about the annual evaluation. So once you resolve the issue about annual evaluation, whether there's a violation or not, the discrimination is not really central to what needs to be fixed, the remedy on that part. The discrimination needs to be addressed by the office that would then do something or make a recommendation. If there was discrimination, they would make that recommendation, but we're not really saying
in that case,
that
would be the case where it would bifurcate.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just
because
trying.
The person might decide, okay, I got, there was a violation, my annual evaluation is going to be changed, I don't need to have the discrimination part reviewed now. Do you see what I'm saying? Because I got my remedy. People tend to throw it in there just because, and I was also discriminated against. Mm-hmm. It's not that we don't want to hear that, but it's like we want to make sure we're focusing on that issue first, and then if there's a problem that needs to be addressed, OIE is the right office to investigate that. Does that make sense?
I was just trying to make sure that your interpretation of how that scenario would be treated was the same as what I thought, and so it is.
Okay.
So I think that tells us that the language is clear enough on that point, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we could certainly put something in about how
the time limits
would be stayed.
Yeah. And you know, I think that's folks will understand that language.
Yeah. Yeah. We do that.
And they really should be automatically stayed.
Yeah, because I guess when you think about it, if OIE is looking at a matter of alleged discrimination, what are you grieving? Because it's not settled yet. It's still under consideration and investigation. So.
Okay. Well, that'll give us something to look at.
Good. Yeah,
and so are those... the only changes in there?
Yeah, I think so.
Because the one that we're still...
Our 6.1 now is not, does not pick up the some of the protected groups that you have in yours, right? So we're still...
The only thing that we don't pick up is the parental status.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, pregnancy is covered under Florida statute.
I thought we had pregnancy in there.
Yeah. It's under Florida statute.
It's under the federal law, too.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's like a protected... It's a protected...
That's just an oversight on the part.
Well, it's unnecessary, I guess, because it's protected by that, but
so is age, disability.
Yeah, of course.
So there's no reason. That's just an oversight, John.
Okay.
Yeah, we certainly intend to include pregnancy as a protected class.
Okay, so then the other protected class that's still not in here that we should talk about is parental status, because that's protected under EEO laws and also under a presidential executive order. And so those are the documents on those.
Can you tell me what you just handed over, John?
Well,
I'll give it to you.
Well, just tell me so that I can...
One's guidance from... EEOC.
Like federal?
Yeah, federal.
Yeah.
And the other one's a presidential document. It's Executive Order 11478 that dates all the way back to the Clinton White House in 2000. So I think if we get those two protected classes included in there, then we're really, really, really close.
What do you intend to use protect? What's an example of what you would use for parental status as a protected class? How would that work?
Well, the same way it would work for anything else. I mean, it's just a neutral. It shouldn't affect any decision making. Decision making is based on job requirements and performance and things like that.
So does that mean that the faculty would no longer be able to request a different time because of their child?
No, they can still do that. I mean, they can request it for any reason.
So if you don't have children, then you can request it because your parental status is you don't have children?
No, you've given that rights elsewhere in the contract. So that's the thing. It's regardless of what your parental status is. It doesn't matter.
So if someone insists that they want to have the 8 a.m. class... and you have someone with kids and someone without kids, and they both want it, there's no...
That's not the determining factor. That's
so
what
I'm
means
not sure
have...
what parental status is. What does it do for the employee? I'm not clear on that part then.
I think you're conflating privilege and discrimination.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to say that someone who has kids can request to have a 10 a.m. class as opposed to an 8 a.m. class
because they want
to drop off their kids. That would be privilege.
Uh-huh.
And discrimination is being assigned something because you have children. Mm-hmm. So if you assign something because... So retaliatory acts against you because you have children.
I guess Charlie's asking, would you have a... Could you have because you don't.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it's retaliatory acts against or decisions that are made that are because you have children or because you don't have children. If someone is making a decision because you have children that is a discriminatory act, that is something that is protected under this article because it's a discrimination article.
I can see where that privilege and that discrimination get really close together, don't they, in that case? Because if you say, I have kids and I really want to be done by 3 o'clock so I can pick them up from school, and you give them that privilege, then you've used it again. The person who also would like to be home by 3 o'clock, I guess I'm not sure that I understand how that's going to work. But you don't have to.
Well, the parental status doesn't come into the equation. Same way disability wouldn't, or sex, anything else.
want to say something, Mike? You have that thoughtful look on your face.
Well,
I mean, the EEO guidance, you know, has some examples and suggestions about.
Well, we'll take a look at it. I think one of the reasons why we have hesitated in the past is not that we want anybody to be discriminated against because they have a child or not a child, you know, but supposed to, on our side of the table, we do not have a comfort level as to how it would be applied practically.
Well, that's interesting because faculty are expected not to treat, it's a right given to students here.
No, but
it's part. Faculty are expected to do it, treating their students in the classroom.
Well, yes,
it's not a problem.
Well, yes and no. In a way, John, I guess, look, let's go back to Charlie's example. Certainly, we would not deny a person admission who qualifies for admission to the University of Central Florida because they are a parent or not a parent, for example. And we would not deny a person employment at the University of Central Florida because they are a parent or not a parent. That's not what we call a bona fide occupational qualification. It's not related to their job. It's not related to their expectations.
The same as for faculty.
But then you get to, like Charlie says, you get to a different level. And the different level is, what if somebody says, if a student came to us, though, and said, you need to change the time when you deliver your course. It's currently at 2:30, and I need it at 4, because at 2:30, I'm still watching my child, my husband isn't home, or my wife isn't home by then. But they get home at 3:30, and I can make that course at 4. You would say, no. But no, we're not changing the course because you have a child care issue. We have 18 other people that are 17 other people that are taking this course. We're not changing that. We have a whole lot of reasons why it's at 2:30.
This would be
that's not me. That's a management right.
In that case, a student has an online option.
Right. Yeah. So you have a faculty member who says, "I need to teach that course at 4:00 instead of 2:30 because my husband and wife isn't home yet." And we say, "We don't want to do that. We want it at 2:30." There's a lot of good reasons why we wanted a 2:30. Oh, well, listen, you're discriminating against me because I had this child care issue, and I have a child. If it wasn't for that child, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We wouldn't be having this dispute. And I think that's our concern, is how far does that go? We know how far it would go with regard to, and the reason why I think is this. I'm scatting here.
I can tell.
Yeah. I'm thinking out loud. I get into some really dangerous water. I'm thinking out loud about discrimination. This,
for example,
most protected classes that I can think of, with the exception of one, does not drive behaviors. There's no behaviors associated with that, necessarily. I would think there's a couple that do.
Disability,
pregnancy.
Could be age, which could relate to.
Could be age. Not age, really.
I mean,
but disability, I was thinking of disability. Those are areas where there's not, that you have to accommodate. So it's not just don't deny equal consideration to everyone else, whether they don't use it against them, but you have no, but in all these other areas there's no reason to accommodate. You only accommodate in handicap. You might accommodate in pregnancy, actually not even pregnancy really, because to get an accommodation under pregnancy you have to almost bump into handicap. You know what I mean? You have to have some sort of
complications
or something. So that's what I think our concern is. Like, that's why I said we don't have some comfort over here. Am I saying something?
You're saying, no, I think you've hit it.
We don't know where that bright line is where we can say, we're going to open the door up to all sorts of people who read this as giving them some sort of right or accommodation obligation, because being a parent drives behaviors as opposed to all the others. You know, being, I say that is because, I said it because I'm a labor and employment attorney, but also because I'm an employer. And I have people coming to me and asking me for accommodations all the time. Actually, through my whole career, you know, and you know, and I've always tried to accommodate people who have, you know, I think I do a pretty good job of it, you know.
Would hope so.
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, actually, I'm bragging myself. When I was in 1987, when I became chairman of PERC, I said that anybody on my staff could split a position if they wanted to for childcare. And a lot of the hearing officers made arrangements and split positions and said, this is awesome. Nobody would do this before for us. I had two little children at the time, too, so I guess I was being driven by my own. Can I split this position? I needed to split my position. But that's what the concern is. You know, I do know that people come in and say to me, I cannot be at work before 9. And in my law office, we have obligations that start regularly before 9. You know, court appearances, travel. And we try to work that out with them, but we're concerned about someone saying, I have this right to be accommodated because I have children. Is that our concern?
Because we have had that happen.
I mean, but people are going to say things, whatever. We can't change that, how people are going to interpret it. I mean, we approach that when if people want to grieve, then our side, your side, we talk to those people. If they're not interpreting it properly, then we can talk to them about that, to proper interpretation. But again, accommodation, discrimination are two different things. And I'll give you an example. You know, it's about phrasing. It's about the intention behind the act of the administrator with the person who's seeking those seeking something. So I have to approach my administrator with something. For instance, I asked for this example, let's say it's hypothetical. Approach an administrator about having a large class, 300 students in an exam hall, having a visual impairment, not being able to negotiate cheating students. So I have a concern about that. And so the administrator could say, well, we don't have the funding for that. Say, okay. Now, if the administrator says, well, we don't have the funding for that, but maybe you shouldn't, you know, but no other faculty members have problems. I don't want to pay for the funding for that because no other faculty members have problems viewing a large classroom. That second statement, that's discriminatory towards someone with a visual disability. The first statement's not. And it's about the intention behind the act of them making that claim.
If I can, Nick. You know, what we have experienced over the last couple of years, in my observation, is that from our side of the table, we have given examples. I'm not saying your example here today. We've given some examples, and we would say, would that apply? Would that person, that situation, have a grievance? And we were told yes. To the point where we were suggesting accommodation type requests, not just I'm not getting hired, but practical changes to their work obligations and expectations as opposed to everyone else, which is an accommodation. So
I mean, it could lead to an accommodation.
So we've asked that to try to see how broadly this would apply. And when your responses have been, which is fine because that's your right to say we want this and we want it broadly interpreted, you've articulated back to us what we hear as a very broad application of the protection.
We're not seeking anything more broad than what's already in federal law. And I'll remind you that the EEO law, because UCF gets so much federal money, and faculty now have figured out that one of the ways to redress grievances here is to step outside of UCF and go directly to their funding agencies. And that's going to be the other alternative.
Well,
so you kind of got That's the other thing that's looming on the horizon. Because faculty have figured that out, and now they're talking to each other about it. And instead, they're going to go right to NSF. They're going to go to NIH or whoever and call in those folks. They've already figured it out.
But
they're not the only ones who figured that out. Never mind.
Yeah, but at the same time, what we're doing here is creating a separate right beyond what you've given to us today, John, which we'll gladly read, a separate right, and that's a contractual right, and a separate cause of action and redress, which is an arbitration, which doesn't exist in the law. So that's why we want it. That is our concern. That's always been sort of our pause for going there. I'm just telling you so you understand our concerns. I know that you, Nick, as a group, as a team, in the past have given us examples that we thought like, whoa, we think that's a little beyond what is intended by the law. That's a reach. You know, Charlie was trying to bring it up. Somebody asks for an accommodation, and whether they're with children or whether they're without children, they both get to complain if it's not granted. And I thought the answer this earlier today was yes. So anyway,
someone without children who's sometimes been in a situation where the situation was, people without children are the ones who have to work on holidays. And that's not uncommon at all in the workplace. Now, we don't have it here because we don't work on holidays. Faculty don't work on holidays.
Well,
no, we're not required to work on holidays.
Yeah, last week at Christmas, though, you've been here more than others.
Oh, I have been, yeah. I'm the one who's always stuck in the office because I don't have family obligations.
There are some days when the university is closed and open and the schools are not.
Yeah, I recognize that. But my point is, I could grieve and say I'm being treated unfairly because I don't have kids, and that's just the assumption. You're the one that always has to demand to take the bad shifts on the days when people who have kids have them. So it's
difficult grievance. I mean, that just seems like an easy loss.
There's no intent behind the act of scheduling you in a certain, maybe there is,
but the situation you're describing does not imply intent.
Oh, I think it's pretty clear in her office that people with children are
She could be an outstanding worker and they prefer her to work on those days.
Oh, yeah.
It has nothing to do with her.
Well, clearly
parental
you haven't been at a grievance meeting.
Because that's never the argument that's put forward.
There's a lot of the variables.
Yeah.
Is there ever the opposite, where like people want to bring their children and the chair's like, you can't have your children in your office?
I don't know. We have, I mean,
not that
office,
I ever, we had kids in 20 years here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I raised my two children here through the help of Creative School. And yeah, I know.
Yeah. So I can laugh at kids in our office on days when the school
he's paying no attention.
I had my daughter sitting, you know, when I had to, because I always got the 8 o'clock in the morning classes, and that meant my final exams were always scheduled for 7 a.m. in the morning before Creative School opened, and so Sarah would sit underneath my desk with crayons.
I think there's a big difference between a child who can sit quietly and a child who's bouncing off the walls and disrupting others.
I don't think she was disrupting.
If your child can't control him or herself, they're 2 years old or whatever, you can't put them in that environment and have them sit quietly. And that would be a disruption to others, and I think they would be asked not to do it. I mean, I wouldn't want to be the supervisor in that situation, but you'd have to.
There was this one scenario where this one department kept, they kept doing these meetings at 5 o'clock. So the person who was organizing at 5 o'clock, and she did it almost like it was retaliatory because she knew two women had two kids who were in creative school, mm-hmm. and you got to go pick them up. So the kids have to come. And then when the kids would arrive in the meetings after 5, they were those type of kids. They wanted to play. They were small. Yeah. That person who organized the meeting, it was almost like she didn't like these two women. She went and complained to the chair that they can't control, their kids, and you know, it's very unprofessional to bring your children. So in that case, I thought it was retaliatory, and that's where like a, something about parental status would at least deter some
or
of these bad actions.
Skills.
Hmm?
Parenting skills, maybe.
Like,
yeah.
I was thinking when I put it in there, more like a sort of a deterrent so that somebody doesn't try to do something that is, like, negative like that. Because then they report it to the chair. The chair, this was one of those chairs that actually did look at the CBA and said there's nothing here about it, so let's just try to all get along. and had, like, a sort of a powwow with everyone.
Yeah, but see, I think this comes back to what I was saying. And that is... If someone were to say to this faculty member, because you have children in creative school, you might need to be somewhere at 5 o'clock and you might miss a meeting and you might not meet your job expectations, so I'm not even going to consider you for a job. Which is really, you know, so I'm going to discriminate against you on that basis. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
I get that being what they're trying to
avoid. Intent, like something like that, where someone's.
But for somebody to have a meeting scheduled at 5 o'clock and say, "Well, I can't make it because I have childcare obligations, and I have a contractual right not to go to the meeting because I have childcare obligations." I don't think that's the intent of the law.
Yeah, that wasn't the intent. No, these people were good. Like they picked up their children early. They came to the meeting. They wanted to do that, but that what they didn't expect is the person almost did it all. Was expecting the kids to be a little out of control and then to the report on them. So it was retaliatory.
Right. What if someone shows up with their children and they, to some person trying to run the meeting, they just distract and disrupt and they go, "You can't have your children here."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, see, these are all these things that we do not want to be grievances because I think it reaches beyond the scope of the federal protection.
And we don't want to be in a position of saying no one can bring their children to work because we definitely don't want to lay down something that harsh because we're reacting to trying to minimize grievances because of that situation.
And we just want to be more humane than that. I mean, we've got kids in our office. Every time there's
a school holiday,
mm-hmm.
we got kids in the general counsel's office. Just because Scott's very family friendly.
Well, we're going to make a proposal to address that issue as well.
What?
Kids in the office.
Coming.
Kids in the GC's office.
No, the discontinuity in scheduling.
Oh, okay.
Not having breaks aligned with the local school districts. That's coming.
Not having breaks in line.
So we're going to have to set the university calendar to match the, except that Seminole and Orange are different.
Not anymore.
Okay, so they're in the same. So, okay.
They got smart.
Well, we have campuses in Gavard. We have campuses.
Yeah.
Don't we? Osceola.
Yep.
They don't all online.
Yeah, but the main campus and most of the employees are here.
Yep.
Well,
no, they already. We can get more in alignment than we currently have, pretty easily.
Well,
but that's for another time.
Yeah, we'll consider that.
So since we've already blown through an hour, we better give you because you've given us something to look at.
Okay.
Actually, do you have another one for us?
No, I think that's it.
No, put my team down.
Okay.
All
right.
Okay. And then we'll give you our two.
Plenty to put down.
Oh, well, give them to us. Then we don't have to meet for 8 hours on the next three times.
Oh, I'm thinking we're going to be doing that anyway, probably, or something similar.
Cool.
This is just conflict of interest and outside activity. And I can go through this pretty quickly. We stay pretty close to status quo on this. And I don't, this isn't numbered, but in 19.4A, it used to say on a form provided by the university to the employer's supervisor, and I just changed that to the on the potential outside activity, the online form.
Right.
Because we don't hand you out a form anymore.
Right.
That wasn't
Well, it was.
We'll hand you out that form.
We had discussed before when we handed out, I think it was 20, that we were going to move that expedited grievance procedure actually into 19, so I did. And the one thing that's highlighted is current language says a request for arbitration using Appendix E shall be filed. When we do expedited grievance procedures for ADR, we do mediation. It seems sensible to me to make the two expedited procedures match, and especially because if you're trying to expedite something, as you know, it takes forever and a year to get an arbitrator.
Mediator's much faster.
Mediator's much faster, but that is the current language, and you know, I will let you all discuss if you're willing to make that change. It's basically, they're both binding. It's just basically that one is quicker than the other, and I'm trying to align the two expedited procedures. But otherwise, we didn't make changes to that that I remember.
Sherry, I just wanted to make a correction.
Okay.
The ADR process, the mediation, is not binding.
No.
It says the suggestion is not binding on the university, but shall be.
Sorry.
I think we've considered it.
Yeah, we've always done whatever they said,
yeah.
So we always considered it that.
We haven't used it very often.
Once since I've been here.
Yeah.
Which is 20 years.
Oh, really? Once in 20 years?
Once ADR usually gets figured out before it gets to mediation.
Yeah,
so that's that's a really low probability then.
Yeah.
With 1,500 or so faculty every year.
I don't think we have a lot of problems with conflict of interest stuff, but you know, maybe I'm not in that office, so I don't know.
I think the main issue a lot of the questions that come to me are about what activities apply, what activities do people need to file for. Mm-hmm. And the usual advice is, if you've got any doubt, file it.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Just file it.
It then hurt.
Well,
yeah.
Then it protects you, because you've got a sign-off that it's okay if I do Girl Scouts. Yeah.
Are there any plans to have faculty evaluate administrators' outside activity?
What?
Like our chairs, like what do they do on the outside? Because we don't have access to that information, but they have access to ours. I'm just wondering.
Well,
can we look at what you guys are doing outside? I don't know.
I have to file that same form.
Can faculty see what administrators do on the outside?
I suspect that are these public records?
It's not evaluative.
It's not evaluative. I would think it would be.
It seems like that would be public records. I mean, we just went through the statutes last time, right?
Yeah,
it seems
I don't
like
know why you couldn't ask for my outside activity report.
You'll be shocked.
Shocked.
Yes.
You mean this is not her day job? All
righty, so that was 19.
Secretly, she's a secret agent.
Good discussion.
Yeah, for a while, I actually had some when I was on my condo board, but now I'm just really boring. I'm outside of work.
Yeah, I take pride in no outside activity.
Okay, well, you've given us a couple, so let's give you a couple.
Okay.
So let me see. Make sure I keep my copy. So the printer at one point started to run out of ink, so some of these copies are just black and white.
Okay. Let me make sure Charlie gets a color
copy. I would
copy.
Really like one if you're feeling that kind.
I'll take a black one.
Okay.
Just before we talk, can you give some sort of rationale about when you're moving everything? Because I noticed that Article 17 is staying the same, and some of the others stay the same. Do you have
have some sort of listing that you want to share with us of where you're going? A map?
Yeah, I can give you a map the next time. Yeah, I can do that.
I'm not sure I understand why you want to do it, but
well, it's just to make things easier to understand and put like things together.
Well, it's not working for me so far.
Okay. I know, because
okay.
The part of the pattern isn't there.
We had one. You didn't share it.
You didn't share a plan of where we're going to change things?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Nope.
I can do
top
that,
secret.
Though. Top secret. So this is Article 17 leaves, and so the change in the top is basically to, because all the different sorts of leaves are addressed one by one through there, is just to eliminate language that we don't really need and just say, here are the types of leaves that UCF has. There are a bunch of small, mostly grammatical changes through this. On line 41, you can see there we've got holidays. I know HR maybe classifies those as paid leaves, but it seems like that would belong better in Article 9, where you've got assignment of responsibilities and talks about the work week and work hours and those things that, okay, and here are the holidays and the other things. And so that's why in line 54 to 55,
okay,
we put in that little holder that...
I just started to write that, and then you
had it. Yep. The FMLA is mostly just cleaning up language again. In what's now 17.6 in line 69... We talked last full book session about paid family leave. That was our starting point, and then we wound up with parental leave. And part of what was articulated to us was baby steps. So this is the next baby step. And so you'll see the language there.
Which
one? 69. And so the blue clause, it's from 75 to 81, is a definition of, okay, what are the types of things that would qualify under family leave. Trying to think if... I mean, most of the rest in this section is just condensing it to family leave instead of parental. Basically, caring for a seriously ill family member.
Primary caretaker of a seriously ill immediate family member.
Immediate family is defined in definition.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said family leave, not immediate family leave. So I just kind of wanted to make sure I understood.
Yeah. Let's see what else.
Mm-hmm.
Over on page 5, from lines about 192 down to 202, so just condensing that a little bit so that the employee's personal appointments with a healthcare provider just gets moved up a line. But then making it obvious that employees can use sick leave for the illness of an immediate member of their family, illness or injury or appointments with healthcare providers, as well as if there's a terrible case of a death in someone's family. And then in... on page 6, from lines 247 to 255, we found out that if you just struck a date that was up above in 236, then you could then strike out this whole paragraph. So it's just shortening things. And then on page 7, we've expanded the language about the sick leave pool and how that operates. So some of the language, again, that's been held on other sites got moved in there. And there have also been some changes that we made to that one as well. So the idea is that the sick leave pool should be able to operate through HR without having some intermediary committee evaluating the request. So if the person is a member of the pool, they have the hours accrued, they have the medical circumstances and their own sick leave circumstances that then would dictate that they'd be eligible, they should then have access to the sick leave pool. And it should be immediate access, not with a 2-week delay between it.
Did you talk to just to know, did you talk to anybody about why there's a 2-week delay? Did you talk to anybody about why there's a committee at all? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm just asking you if you did.
I did make a call.
You did?
Yeah, I made a call. I just talked to someone, and they said, well, the 2 weeks, I didn't ask about the 2 weeks. I asked about the 2 weeks delay. And the thing was that processing.
He doesn't know he's talking.
Does anyone from HR here?
Not this week, no. I didn't know you would be putting down
But it was just said that's how long it took to process. So from the time that they agreed to it, to accept that they will get sick leave, that it would just take processing. That's why it took 2 weeks. That was the answer on the phone.
I guess I'm not understanding what. So you turn in your form, the committee meets, and they.
It's actually the director of human resources who can make. The committee is just advisory. So that's also where you took. It's just advisory. The actual person who makes the decision is the director.
Okay.
Yeah, and so you turn in your form, the director approves it, and it's something because of that 2-week delay with our paychecks.
Uh-huh.
So that's why it's like processing, and also because of that 2-week delay. Someone from HR can really explain it, but I know anytime we get money, we always have to wait almost 2 weeks.
Well, that's, I think, because when you start working, I guess it depends on the day you start, but there's the delay because you have to accumulate the time in there.
So, but the thing is, in the original language, it also said that you had to be completely out of sick leave before you could even apply. So this would, our intent was that you could apply, because usually, like, if you have cancer or something, you know when you're about to end, your sick leave is about to end.
Uh-huh.
Being able to apply before your sick leave ends.
Okay.
So understanding, yes, I understand that there's that 2-week delay, but then allow the person to apply before their sick leave is complete.
And did they give you a rationale for why they want you to be all out of sick leave?
I didn't know.
Okay. I'm just curious. I don't know. So
because that's why the sick leave pool got created, is for folks who've run out of their own personal sick leave.
I know what it's for. I just didn't know. I didn't think to push on those areas and find out why those are there. If it's just historical, because we've always done it that way.
I think it's probably because they've always done it that way.
Okay.
But
the original language, you had to wait, and that's why there was this 2-week delay. But I know now, like with the cancer process, like you pretty much know when you're about to run out, because you know, okay, this is when you have surgery, this is when you have your radiation or chemotherapy.
So our biggest concern is not having that 2-week pay gap between running out of sick leave and then possibly getting sick leave from the sick leave pool.
All right, so I'll talk to them and find out what the answers to those questions are. I just wanted to know if you already had a rationale that was like, oh, well, they said this, and okay, that's fine. A lot of times you can use sick leave pool for intermittent leave so that you don't know exactly how it's going to run out, but that's fine. I understand the issue.
And then a bunch of small things. Yeah, with annual leave, having giving employees more latitude to decide when they can take those leaves, as opposed to having them always be at the discretion of the supervisor, who can decide to play favorites on that. I'm sorry.
419 to 420.
Yeah, 418 to 421. I'm trying to think Yeah, then one of the other interesting things as we were doing our research on different sorts of leaves that are in statute and things is on line 547. So if we have the great fortune of having, you know, someone on the faculty who's an official part of the Olympic delegation, then athletic competition leave is something we already had that they would then be eligible for.
Never know.
I thought
we have a
you know,
already.
It requires, yeah.
We have student athletes go to the Olympics here.
Sure.
Several times.
Yeah. I thought we already had.
I'm not sure about faculty or members of our bargaining unit.
Well, if they're coaching them, I guess they could be.
Yeah, we have
some similar.
The police union does that also.
Yeah. And then on the bottom of page 13 and headed over to page 14, some new language to protect victims of domestic and sexual violence.
Yes.
And then you use your annual leave or sick leave or other, it gets credited against that. And I think those are the major elements. So some you've seen before, a few are new ones. That in doing research we found were already available, or, and then there are a few tweaks of others.
Okay.
Okay, so that's 17. So this one, unfortunately, I don't have colors at this point. Copier had run out. This is 20. And I was ambitious at the beginning and did two colors of, because this is actually tracked off of your first proposal on the grievance procedure. So when you see the gray highlighting, that's where we've adopted language that you suggested.
Okay.
And I know on the first page it looks like, oh, there's no gray and no lots of yellow. But later on, there's more gray, including on the last page. So it's not quite totally balanced, but it's pretty close.
Okay, so I'm looking at yours, and I see a lot of yellow on mine. I describe that as gray, but that's not gray.
Oh, because
it's all gray, according to the art copy.
I don't have a color.
Mine is gray.
No, I'm trying to look. So the dark.
Well, maybe if you could send.
Once you give them
the
color.
Yeah, I can send you the copy.
That would be
cool. I only have one, and then that ran out.
Yeah, if you could.
It was the black that ran out, the black ink.
Would that work for you, Charlie?
It would.
Yeah.
If he emails it to me, then I can just
Turn
off.
Or here, I'll put it right on your little drive there. I'll give you both of ours.
Explain it. Do I have a good caucus?
Is there an issue or issues that you want to say something to us about regarding the proposal?
Well, probably one that's more pragmatic than anything else is on line 44. So in the back of our current CBA, we've got three appendices for different types of grievances.
Uh-huh.
And two out of the three are darn near identical. And so instead of having these different ones, we thought, let's just have a common one and you just check off the box or which step you're at. And then we've only got one form, and it'll make it easier for folks to handle and keep track of.
Okay. So you redesigned the form at Appendix 6.
It's not included.
Well, we haven't done that yet because we wanted to see if you were amenable to it. But if you're amenable to the idea, then we can together work out the form.
Right.
Yeah. We can make it so.
I think that's going to be more challenging than you think, but I'd be interested to see what you would suggest.
We can do it. One of the things that you had in your version that we didn't include in ours is in lines 207 to 209.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the color version, that's in yellow. In your version, it was struck out.
And so...
So you...
This is what
you still want to meet within 90 days after the execution of the agreement for the purpose of selecting a panel?
Yep.
Huh. Okay.
Sometimes I receive marching orders.
Okay.
Okay, let me give you this stuff on this. So... just give you Article 17, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Article
20. Just put them all on there, yeah.
Yeah, give you both. Okay, make sure it's on
there. You hear anything about Candy Churchill lately?
Mm-hmm. No.
Why?
Have you?
Well, because she used to be... I was thinking about getting together to select this panel. It was always Candy and I did it the last time.
Yeah, it'll be Tom.
And it seems to be Candy's just kind of disappeared into the ether. Now it's all Tom.
Restructured.
They just restructured, so now Tom's our service rep.
And then we're going to change again because they just hired a new person. So in a couple of years,
we'll have a new person. Oh. Yeah. I thought you might have heard something either good or bad.
Take Candy any day over time. Okay. That's on tape. All right, do you want me to pause the recording while I go? Are you going to keep going, or are we going to go to caucus?
Do you have something else, Tom?
No, those are the two we have for you today.
All right, let's do that.
Okay.
Before we do, the first is that if you want to take an effort to develop the single form for grievances, we would be interested in seeing that and entertaining that.
Okay.
As a change in the thing. The other thing is, I have this suggestion in response to your proposal to expand the scheduling of the negotiations going forward. I think the first date that you suggested an expansion of the time is July 17th. And what we're willing to do is to turn that into a half-day bargaining session. And we would suggest that it would run from 10 to 2.
On the 17th?
On the 17th. And then why don't we see what our experience is like with an expanded bargaining session, and then we'll come back and talk about whether we should have a similar change on the second.
We've done 4 hours before.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done that. I think, like, today we're running out of time, and we have something to show you.
Yeah.
Well, we're working on it, but we can just...
email it to us.
Yeah, we can email it to you.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, we could email it to you ahead of time and then put it on the table formally, right?
All right, that's good.
Yeah.
So what we're working on, just so you know, is that...
is that last sentence.
Yeah, that last sentence. And also the last sentence, but also separating the first two sentences to kind of get to the intent that...
got it.
If it's possible to bifurcate them, that's the pathway to take. And then if not, that's the second...
All right, sounds good.
Deal.
Okay.
Right, thanks, everybody.
I guess we'll see you in 4 hours next time.
Well, it's not next time. We have an interim. I mean,
I wrote it down correctly. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, can you give Sherry her pen? This is.
Oh,
I can't get it to click back in. Sorry.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay, guys.
Thanks.
Take care.
You broke my phone, Charlie.
I did it deliberately.
Thank you.
Okay.
I love that.
I'm gonna hit the recording. Sorry. Okay. So.